Welcome to Kaleidoscope, where we talk about the leading cause of pediatric visual impairment in the developed world, cortical visual impairment, CVI. I'm Jessica Marquardt. Some of you have asked, did I extend my summer break into fall? Yes, I guess I did. I needed a little hiatus, but I'm ready to produce more of your stories. If you'd like to share your CVI journey, please email me at thecvipodcast@gmail.com. That's thecvipodcast@gmail.com. I'd really like to hear from you. Today's guest has been an advocate on big stages, on everyday social media platforms, and in day-to-day life on behalf of her son. Cheyenne Marcy, mom to Archer, values action and advocacy, and she has navigated not one, not two, but three state education systems. She's come to terms with speaking up for Archer and kids like him, even when it's uncomfortable. And she sees every situation as an opportunity to teach others about the characteristics of CVI. Whether you're a friend in her home or a professional serving her son, Cheyenne will share her depth of knowledge on CVI and how it affects Archer on every level. I had the opportunity to connect with Cheyenne to discuss the vital services and accommodations for children with CVI, her unwavering resolve to secure resources for Archer, and a new topic to me, neuromovement. Cheyenne?
Hello.
Hi.
How are you doing today?
Oh, it's a Monday, right?
Yeah. Yes, I hear you. Did you have a good weekend?
It was full, but got some quality time in with Archer, and so that's what it's all about on the weekends.
Yeah. What does he like to do on the weekends?
Pretty much snuggle with me because I work a couple of extra jobs, so I serve at night during the weekends, and so when he gets me, he wants me, and he loves to be outside.
Well, it seems like you're constantly on the go, like hiking and enjoying the outdoors. I see your pictures, so
yeah, we are definitely happiest outside.
The fresh air is good. So we could start at the beginning, or we could start looking back to when Archer was about 8 weeks old, because I read somewhere that you say you stopped checking developmental guidelines and those What to Expect books at about that time in his life. What was it about Archer that you were noticing when he was 8 weeks old? And can you take us back to that time?
Yes, I can. So by 8 weeks old, I had not received any eye-to-eye contact while I was breastfeeding. And that was the thing that I wanted as a brand new mom, is to have that special bond. Yes, I was bonding during the moments of breastfeeding, but he would never bring his gaze up to me. And there were other things. Archer is multiply disabled and has various brain anomalies that affect him other than just cortical visual impairment. And so there was very little movement coming out of him, and his tone was very low. And so the doctor said, we knew there was going to be some complications with Archer. We just didn't know to the extent of what they would be. And at that point, I felt like it was time to start addressing what we were seeing. He had already begun having seizures at this point. I'm a very proactive person, and I didn't want to let him. I wanted to do something for him. I wanted to find some help. And obviously, he wasn't reaching any of these milestones that I was reading about. And so really, I guess when my advocacy started for him is I started asking questions. I started getting referrals to different doctors, and we went from there.
So he was having seizures, infantile spasms. You said the low muscle tone.
The infantile spasms did not start till he was 4 months old. He was having focal seizures at that point. Yeah.
Okay. And then is that about the time that you were referred to a geneticist? Or did that come later?
No, we saw a geneticist. Oh, he was probably about, it was in April, so he was like 12, 15 weeks long at that point. Mm-hmm. We saw an ophthalmologist and a geneticist, those, and neurology. Those were our first three referrals.
First three of many, I'm sure.
Yes.
You had said that the geneticist noticed Archer's whorls. And you're talking about his hair, right? The whorls in his hair. So can you describe his beautiful hair for us? And then what, according to the geneticist, did that signify?
So Archer does have beautiful hair, a sandy brown blonde in the summertime. And it is just this kind of wild and crazy. I always thought they were calyxes, kind of a natural mohawk. And when it's a neurological disability, I have a tendency to be a researcher. So I started looking at the corpus callosum, and it literally looks like the nerve fibers of a corpus callosum atop his head externally. So he's got these whorls. I have curly hair, and I always just thought it was him having a bunch of calyx like me. Well, we had seen a series of geneticists. We unfortunately kept on getting geneticists that were retiring. And so by the third or fourth geneticist that we saw when he was about 3 years old, the geneticist kept on saying, your child has very distinct features. And I was like, oh yeah, thank you. Like, I know he's, you know, he's very charming. Everybody falls in love with him when they see him, and especially commenting on his hair. And little did I know that the whorls in his hair were a direct reflection of one of his brain anomalies, which is periventricular nodular heterotopia.
What does that mean?
That is basically all of the matter starts in, the white matter starts in the center of the brain. And as the child is growing in the womb, it begins to spread out exteriorly as the brain develops. And this is early in the womb, I would say 3 to 5 weeks. Archer also has bilateral enlarged ventricles. And we know our ventricles are where fluid passes. And because of these ventricles, the white matter was not able to spread out to the exterior of his brain, which also houses the vision centers of his brain. So heterotopias, end of story, basically are create seizures because it's roadblocks, it's clumps where information is not being spread to the various parts of the brain. And that is, those heterotopias are, little that I know, the reasoning behind his hair kind of growing in these abnormal patterns.
That's amazing.
Yes.
I've never heard that before, but when I read that, that had stopping power for me. I think that's really interesting. And the geneticist, how tuned in, you know, to be thinking about more than just a brain scan, right? What are the other things that we can notice just visually with our naked eye that might point to some of the things that are happening right there inside the brain? You call yourself a researcher when it comes to neurological sorts of things. What else do you know about Archer's neurology and his other diagnoses that you've learned since he was born?
Yeah, I kind of explained a little bit about, he does have a genesis of the corpus callosum. And for those of you that don't know what a corpus callosum is, it is the largest nerve channel that connects our left and right brain. And in some cases, there may be a partial, and in Archer's case, it is completely absent, which means it never formed and never will. However, there are other communicating nerve channels that connect the left and right hemispheres. So the brain is plastic. We thank goodness for brain plasticity, because Archer is able to learn in different ways. He also has, I mentioned, a seizure disorder that's uncontrollable still. Not uncontrollable in the essence of thinking he has seizures daily or multiple seizures, but he does have them, about a handful of them every month or so, and any seizure is detrimental, really. So he has a seizure disorder, and then I mentioned the periventricular gray matter heterotopia is not white matter, which also affects the occipital lobe. And in the occipital lobe, we know there are vision sources there. I expressed he has enlarged ventricles. He has duplications on his 11th chromosome. And then he also has some smaller deletions that are on, I think, the 5th and the 9th chromosome that are currently being researched. We actually saw a geneticist on Friday, and so we're excited for us to continue to move forward in the genetic world.
Is that pretty rare?
Yes, this is very rare. Archer is the only one reported at this time to have this combination of duplications. For that matter, these exact duplications even. So it is very rare, but we look at that in the light of we can forge the path for Archer instead of having some expectations. He gets to be the one to show the world what his expectations are.
That's a nice perspective. Very nice. Can you tell us about the day that you learned that Archer has cortical visual impairment?
Yes. At this point, Archer was about to be 8 months old, and we had gone through several different doctor's appointments at this time when he experienced infantile spasms from age 4 months to 6 months. There were a lot of appointments, EEGs, and follow-ups weekly, shots we had to give him multiple times a day to stop them. So Archer's father and I had attended all of the appointments together. At this point, it was summertime, and I was feeling pretty confident that I was strong and could take this appointment on my own. It was very close to home, so there was little travel involved. So I went, I arrived at the appointment. We had already seen this ophthalmologist once before, and he had asked me a list of questions that he asked me prior, like, does your child attend to lights? And does your child attend to ceiling fans? Can you mention any times where you feel like your child is visually engaging? And I had mentioned that I feel like he does engage when we're walking around the house, more like he might follow us if we walk from the kitchen to the living room. So movement, and after him going through the gamut of tests, he went out of the room and then he came back in and he said, today I'm going to give you a diagnosis. And he said that it was cortical visual impairment. And at this point I was happy because all the questions he asked me, I had said yes to. So I was like, yes, you know, like we finally have some answers coming towards us. Little did I know what those answers were and how it would affect our future. He gave me a one pager with information on it. And when you sent me these questions, I actually went back through my files to see if I had it. And I actually do have
really?
The one pager. Yes. However, with the information that I know now, it's a fairly good, like, one pager. After the appointment, I was starving, and so I went to a restaurant. Again, this is me by myself at this point with my child in the carrier, and I ordered some food, and while I was waiting for my food to come, I decided that I would pull out the one pager and read it. And all I can remember from that moment is that the tears just started rolling down my face. My food came. I asked for the server just to box it up and to take care of my bill so I could leave the restaurant as soon as possible, because just a huge emotional undertaking was occurring at that time. So I left the restaurant and got in my vehicle, and all of a sudden a humongous downpour started happening on my way home. So I just took it in stride and had to go home and let everything settle. I'm a huge researcher. However, when I research, I want it to be true and factual and it not to be a skewed version of anything. So I kind of let the information settle. We were living in Montana at this time, and we were referred to the Deafblind program. And so I wanted to sort of wait for, you know, an expert of what I believe to be an expert to come and deliver me some more information first. I started researching a little bit about it, but again, I didn't want to find invalid information.
Right.
I didn't want my first opinions about cortical visual impairment to be skewed. I wanted them to be correct, and I wanted what I was going to put in place for adaptations to be the correct ways.
So looking back, are you kind of surprised you got that one pager?
You know, now that I have become a part of this group of parents and professionals. I am surprised hearing other people's stories that they were left with really no information. I do feel that this ophthalmologist was a little bit ahead of the game. We had brought up Dr. Roman's name in that actual appointment, and he told me that it was up to me if I wanted to personally travel across, since we were living in Montana, across the states and go see her. But he did bring up her name. So I was very actually impressed. I feel like a fortunate parent that it only took 2 ophthalmology appointments to get our diagnosis. We got our diagnosis at about 8 months and were, you know, referred to a very knowledgeable, top in the country, I consider in the world, professional with cortical visual impairment.
Right. So you got the one pager after being referred to this great ophthalmologist. You were referred to the deafblind program in Montana. And then what happened? So what kind of modifications were made and what kind of services did you receive from that program?
Yeah, the deafblind program operates on a school schedule. So it seemed like eternity to wait 3.5 weeks for the teacher to return to school. But she was anticipating it. She had seen the referral come through and made us top priority. So I think we saw our teacher of the visually impaired probably within 4 weeks of getting the diagnosis. And she came in. We had already started putting some things in place, like blacking out places in our house, kind of looking at where light came in. We had east and west facing windows. And so those were very interesting for our child, but also he light gazed. And so we wanted to give him opportunities to engage his vision with something that was going to be functional or help him engage. And so we would have the curtains closed during certain times so that the light wouldn't just be coming in and him laying there and staring out the windows. I used to be a very patterned individual, and I slowly decreased patterns that were in my house. Curtains became a solid color versus a pattern. Blankets and everything kind of slowly were replaced to have more of a solid, to present more of a solid background, to decrease the complexity of our little infant's environment. And when the deafblind teacher, the visually impaired, came in, she had brought up the information about Little Rooms by Lillian Nielsen and active learning. And so we were happy enough to get a little room through the program.
What is that?
A little room is a little space that is enclosed. Of course, there's an opening on one side. Some people have a resonance board on the bottom so that these little infants that have that may be deaf, maybe blind, maybe a combination, can start getting feedback through their other senses. And the little room had, it was like a pegboard. You could hang various toys down. So in their involuntary movements might come into contact with like a pom-pom hanging down or a bell. We used party beads. However, the little room was a lot of great exploration for him, and he did start to move more. We even actually built a little room of our own at his grandma's house so that when we were visiting, he would have a safe place where he wasn't overwhelmed and overstimulated. But we took the little room to the extreme, I would say, and sort of bypassed, but we just didn't know any better. And we made the little room too complex for our guy with EDI. We hung everything and anything possible just so that he would have an interaction with something. So it was a good thing, but also it was a learning experience for us. And I realized later, looking back at it, that it needed to be decluttered. There needed to be one thing in there. We quickly got involved with the Lighthouse for the Guild parent support group. And that's when I really started getting information about what we should do And this connection did come from the teacher that visually impaired with the Montana School for the Deaf and Blind. And that's when I was like, oh, this little room is way too much. We needed to simplify things even more. So we were starting to eliminate more of that active learning style and bring in more approach of reducing complexity even more than we already had.
Well, before you implemented the little room and got connected with the Lighthouse Guild to learn a little bit more about complexity and some of the other 10 characteristics of CVI, you knew enough to simplify your home. How did you get that information? What resources did you turn to really initially before anyone even came into your home to give you any advice or before you jumped on a conference call with other parents in similar situations to get advice there?
That would honestly came from my one pager.
Okay.
Yep.
Good.
Yes, it did. Surprisingly, it mentions reducing clutter of the background and using bright colors and lights to make objects more stimulating. It says keeping the surrounding environment simple, uncluttered, and free of interruptions and distractions is helpful for a person with CVI. So really all the modifications, I felt like this is the information that came from the expert. So we're going to follow this sheet of paper to the T before
right.
we get any other valid information coming to us.
Right. So then what happened? How did things kind of develop for you after you got connected with the Lighthouse Guild call and started to expand your opportunities for research and the resources that you had access to?
I started to become more confident in being able to ask questions, first of all, and be able to start slowly explaining to others. Because mm-hmm. when you have a child with a disability, your village is built very quickly. And so people were coming in at this point and wanting to support us. And so that was actually a really beneficial thing for me because it was me practicing explaining what I knew at that point and what we were facing in the future. And so I started asking people to wear darker colors if we are around, or wear a bright colored shirt if you want him to, he's not going to look into your eyes, but if you wear like a bright red shirt or a bright orange, a highly saturated colored shirt, you might get him to make a movement towards you. He had very little movement to the fact that he was still working on rolling at the age of turning 2 years old.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, I had also gotten Dr. Roman's first book and made it a goal to read one chapter a day. Well, that was a pretty hefty goal because I was taking in way too much information and not processing at all. But I can remember sitting up at night and reading her book and literally just bawling because everything I was reading was true to what was going on in our world. And some of us parents call her books our Bibles, our Bibles to our children, because they truly are. A lot of the answers reside in her research.
Well, for a lot of us, it's the first time that we've seen someone describe what we're experiencing or watching our kids go through day to day in such a true way. So you have become a really strong advocate through all your experiences. I mean, you use social media very well to share your experiences. You've spoken at conferences like the American Conference on Pediatric Cortical Visual Impairment that occurs in Omaha. And you have a blog, which people can find at sparkingtheneurons.blogspot.com. So some people might be surprised, but also relate to this quote from you, which I'm going to read. You wrote, "Upon entrance to the Early Childhood Center in fall of 2017, I learned I was not doing enough to advocate for my child's needs. Advocacy begins in your home, with family and friends. It is all too easy to clam up and keep quiet, sometimes feeling like you are explaining things over and over. Then these people are close to you, so offense is taken, and the challenge exists consistently." How do you think you overcame that hurdle, that challenge of speaking up?
Watching my child suffer in environments that are overstimulating, but environments that can easily have a few modifications in place and allow him to better experience possibly being in a group or being at a family member's house and asking, just truly having a voice and not letting my voice be squandered. And I already mentioned, the more I talked to people that were close to me, the more confident I became. And I encouraged individuals to ask questions, because if I didn't have the answer to the question, I would go looking for it. I would ask it on our weekly call if any other parents had experienced it before. I would try to find the answer in Dr. Roman's book, or then really just sit and observe my child. And that's a lot of times what I would tell individuals. I would give them a few cues, like he sees better on his left side. So if you want to interact with him, sit on his left side. He needs time. Again, I'll mention that he not only has cortical visual impairment, but he has a list, a handful of other brain anomalies, and he truly just needs processing time. And for people to be patient with him, not overwhelm him with a ton of questions, and give him that time to react. Because he is and was at that point, I even knew that he is a very intelligent boy, but he needed the time to process. He needed the demand to be reduced for him. I would oftentimes wear, at this point, I would wear black. There's usually always a pattern somewhere. And so I would have one of his toys. This would be an example that I would kind of try a mini lesson I would give to my family member or a friend visiting. I would have a black item of clothing on, or a black blanket that he would be laying on. And I would put his toy up to it, and they would be like, oh, I can clearly see it. And then I would find something patterned. I would put the same toy up to it and have them see the two situations. And then they would start to understand mm-hmm. complexity and why I would be wearing black. And I would have maybe a patterned ball. He's loved balls ever since he was a tiny one. He's a boy. And I would have a patterned ball versus a solid color ball, and people would start to understand. So I think it was just through like little mini lessons and something that is practical right there in the moment that I can use to compare to. Even he's starting to use a fork. Well, we were using these little foam built-up handles, and eats off of a placemat sometimes, depending on what is being served at that night. And I didn't even think myself. I grabbed a red placemat, and then I grabbed, and this was just like literally a week ago, and then I grabbed his fork with the red foam built-up handle, put his fork on the placemat, and said, Archer, look for your fork. It has the pointy tips at the top and then the handle. Well, for the life of him, he was like, Mom, like, where's my fork? Because the red was blending in with the red. And that happened, obviously, it's still happening, but sometimes when we find out that their preferred color is red, for instance, or a different color, our life just becomes flooded with that color and then defeats the purpose of us trying to give him an opportunity to find that preferred color, because everything became the preferred color. And I think a very important point that I've tried to draw home with family and educators is cortical visual impairment is not about the contrast between black and white or yellow and red. It's about reducing the complexity of the visual array, mm-hmm. whether that's the environment or the object itself. It's not contrast, it's complexity.
Yes. Thank you for that. That's hard for, I think, people to break out of that. That's more of an ocular paradigm, and it's hard for people to break away from that and start to think about a visual impairment in terms of complexity, like you said. And thank you for all those examples. Those are really specific, concrete ways that, you know, other people can start to think about how they're going to talk to their family members, their friends, their children's teachers about how can we demonstrate in short bursts what an appropriate modification does in terms of access for our child. Like you had a handful of examples there that probably really brought to light what that means to Archer in his day-to-day life. Those were really good. So he's in kindergarten now, and you told us about kind of the early intervention days. Can you give us the in-between? Like you moved from Montana to Nevada, right? And what happened there? I assume that's where he went to preschool?
Yes. He was still in the early, in the like the birth to three program when we transitioned to Nevada. And we had a great vision specialist, just had not experienced cortical visual impairment. Greatly motivated to learn, but again, was coming from that ocular world. And so reframing the mind to come into the more neurological impairment was difficult. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times I found myself as the parent being the expert providing the information to the professionals, when we oftentimes think it should be the other way around. You know, we should be trusting the professionals to be providing us with their expertise. But again, it's not that I did feel like they were 30 years behind the curve in vision education. And it wasn't the person, it's the education that was delivered to them. There is not a lot of education in the higher ed world provided to special educators or vision specialists about cortical visual impairment. And so they come with this aspect of contrast. And I won't go back to that because I already mentioned it. He transitioned from the birth to three program into early childhood. And at that point, he had some seizures come back pretty intensely, so we kept him home a little bit longer. But when he entered preschool, it was a whole new world for me. I, at this point, 3 years in it, I knew, I feel like, quite a bit about cortical visual impairment, and my heart raced when I was introduced to the classroom. And it was like, how are we going to get him in here and him even be able to function? Mm. And so I slowly started bringing things in. I, again, modeled myself as always wearing black when I took him to school so that I could be there for a few minutes with him and be his stability until they started getting some modifications in place. I brought Dr. Roman's book and had it with me at all times, let them borrow it, and requested that they wear black. They didn't understand the wearing black concept until they started doing it and noticing his functional vision increasing. Mm-hmm. Noticing him turning and looking towards an object, because they themselves, if an educator wears black, they themselves are creating that reduced complexity in this big classroom. And as we know, classrooms are overwhelming, especially preschool classrooms. It took a lot of IEP meeting in preschool. It took a lot of communication as a team. And in the end, Archer came out very benefited by his early childhood experience in Nevada. I was very sad to leave, because by the time we had left, the team got it. The team worked together. They delivered services to him as a group, his OT and speech language pathologist and his aide. He has the need for a one-on-one aide at all times. They would teach him lessons with a trifold, a black trifold on a table. They would have a black felt mat on the tabletop, because the common eye or the common individual may be used to the wood grains of tabletops. Well, we don't even think that that's complex for a child with CVI to find an item. So they used black to put over the table. They took their watches off because watches are shiny and distracting to actually what the child is supposed to be engaging their vision on. The educators wore black gloves and were very quiet. One individual, maybe the OT or the speech language pathologist, would present a item. Archer at this point was working on identifying small objects, circles, triangles, squares, but also farm animals because he is highly motivated by farm animals. So one individual would hold the horse and give salient features of the horse, like the horse has pointy triangle ears. The speech language pathologist would use a red pen light and trace those pointy ears of the horse, the salient feature. And then they would say a horse has a long tail and a mane. And they would trace these features, these salient features, with the pen light so that it would draw Archer's visual attention there. They would also use comparative language and comparing the horse's pointy ears are like a triangle because they were working on shape development and how it correlates into everyday objects. And those everyday objects become the salient features of items. Now, that's the end result of his preschool experience. But the school itself, they transitioned. There were two classrooms joined together and a bathroom was in the middle. Well, Archer would pass through the hallway. And at first, you know, this hallway is, of course, like many classrooms. That's where the storage is. And when I saw that, I said, can we get a black sheet up over that? And it took them a couple of weeks, but they put the black sheet up and Archer independently, he scoots on his rear end. That's how he is mobile. He's still learning to stand and walk. As soon as they put the black sheet up and covered all of that complex material, he independently went from one room to the other room.
Nice.
And so by slowly giving suggestions to the educators, and if they didn't put them in place, I would give it again. And if they didn't put it in place, I would document it in an email, including the entire team. And then usually it would be put in place. But I think in the education world, yes, they are very behind. And I'm not sure about every state, but educators, if you can feed them with a little bit of information at a time and they put it in place, when they put these modifications and adaptations in place in the classroom and they see the child excel at it, that's when they believe in the service that they're providing.
Right. They see some success and that's highly motivating. It sounds like they came to embrace some of the methodologies and accommodations that we'd like to see in place for all of our children. Did that end up in Archer's IEP?
Yes, it did. Speaking of IEPs, yeah. Like, as I mentioned, we had numerous IEP meetings. I think I want to say we had like 19 IEP meetings in his first year and a half of preschool.
That'll take your breath away.
Yes, that goes to show how much of an advocate I am for my child, but I wasn't advocating for just him. I was advocating for all the children in the school district that had CVI and may not have been receiving the proper supports or having the proper accommodations in place. In his IEP, for these things to be in place, I requested for his visual impairment, cortical visual impairment, to be the primary disability listed on his IEP. So that would drive his IEP. Yes, he has other disabilities. Yes, my child is not independently mobile. Yes, my child has other cognitive delays, but cortical visual impairment drives all of the success behind those other disabilities. So I did that. And I also had the 10 characteristics put in each individual characteristic put into the modification section of the IEP. I even went as far as requesting a knowledgeable professional in cortical visual impairment. And these professionals are starting to come out of the woodworks more and more thanks to the Perkins Roman CVI endorsement. However, in Nevada, there was not access to one of these, and I requested for the team to take the Perkins course on cortical visual impairment. They went on to take the 8-week course with Dr. Roman and then went on to take the 5 to 7 week course with Matt Tejan on complexity. And so they were building up their knowledge base. However, this wasn't enough for me at this point. They were still learning and I didn't consider them experts yet. So I requested for there to be this knowledgeable professional on CVI, and they ended up bringing a professional in from the Midwest that came and became a part of the team. And all the other team members, I can tell you hands down or hands up, however you want to look at that, thanked me as a parent for bringing that professional in because that's what they needed. They did a 1-day in service and just were able to directly apply all of her knowledge right there into his classroom and his learning environment and his IEP.
Yeah, mentorship and guidance is so key because there's, you know, there's a lot to learn out there, but when it comes to actually applying it in the classroom and with the kids, it takes a fair amount of being able to think on your feet and being able to kind of have the concepts really, really embedded and be able to apply it in different situations. So I can see how that having a CVI range endorsed provider come in to mentor and lead is very, very helpful.
Yes.
Did they consider you part of the team? Did you get to participate in these different trainings as well?
Yes, I did. It was a lot of work. Like I said, there were multiple team meetings, but they got the point that I was a team player and it wasn't a mom, parents versus the school. We did truly become an inclusive team and we worked together. I was able to attend these as much as I could. I had my availability to come in and also learn alongside the team, learn with the team. Because a child with cortical visual impairment is not just visually impaired at school. They're not just visually impaired at home. It impacts their every second of their life. And so what is going on in school needs to be interfaced with what's going on at home. And that's when a school team is, I think, operating at the optimal is when we have integration starting at home that flows to the classroom. And what's going on in the classroom is sent home. And so the child is getting the whole picture and understanding all of their transitions and with their visual impairment when the supports are in place.
Mm-hmm. Well said. A holistic view. If you know what's going on in the classroom, you can reinforce at home and vice versa. So tell me about kindergarten. Yes. How's kindergarten going?
Well, I'll give a little cortical visual impairment mini lesson on what's going on in kindergarten. So I didn't know, but we had a team meeting and how the children's school day starts is typically with lunch count. So you either say hot lunch or you have your lunch box. Well, Archer's preferred color is red. So of course he has a red lunch box. And just to make the process quicker in the mornings, I was packing his lunch and putting his lunchbox in his backpack and off we go out the door. Well, that being the first thing, that was the connection between home and school. So I started after breakfast putting his lunchbox on the table and saying, are you ready to go to school? You're having cold lunch today. Here's your lunchbox. Your lunchbox is a big red triangle with a zipper on it and a handle at the top that is like a loop. So we started talking about his lunchbox and then would put it in his backpack together. Well, at school, he started seeing red lunchbox. And that concept was connected. Mm-hmm. He's a very auditory learner. But when that visual concept is added into the learning process, then the child with cortical visual impairment is able to just excel in their learning. Mm-hmm. They're not struggling like, what is a lunchbox? You know, they actually have that concrete item and get to learn.
Cool.
So that's kindergarten. He's already been to 2 different schools. He's now started at his second school. And his first school, it was a matter of a couple of different things. We had about 3 meetings in 4 weeks of school, and there was an address change, and so we were facing a change of school anyways, but we were also looking at supports in our community and have chose to move him to a different school. At this new school, they have a little bit more structured resource and integration into the regular classroom, so it's a really good choice for Archer, and they're learning. And the learning curve is huge for educators with CVI, but when they put some major supports and modifications in place, they see it, and Archer is able to learn. I got a little progress note sent home from his orientation mobility specialist. She was observing him in the new school, and he has a tendency to throw items, not out of behavior always, but because he likes to hear the sound of what it makes when it drops on the ground. And so they're trying to work on this behavior with him. And the teacher started using a flashlight. If he threw an item on the ground, the teacher was using a flashlight to spot, like, oh, let's look on the ground and see where you threw it. I think that's just incredible for him only being there for 4 weeks, and her moving beyond this act of throwing and truly linking that concept, oh, well, where did it go in space? She's using a CVI support of activating light to find the object. Mm-hmm. And so he's starting to get that concept. He's really enjoying being included in with his peers. It's been reported that his peers play with a red ball with him out at recess and roll the red ball back and forth. And there's always a handful of kids around wanting to play with Archer. So I'm very pleased. I know that children with CVI have various levels of abilities, and they don't always need to be in a special needs classroom, because it's really just the vision support that they need. They might need some space to have some downtime and reduce complexity. But I'm pleased with the balance of inclusion in the class in his mainstream kindergarten classroom, and then the inclusion that occurs in his resource room.
I'm really glad to hear that, Cheyenne. It's hard. Every time you make a transition, you feel like you're starting from the ground up and rebuilding a program, you know, with new people who need to learn about Archer and clue into to his needs. So that sounds really promising.
Yes. It was gut-wrenching to move schools only 4 weeks into kindergarten, but sometimes you do have to follow your gut. And if that's what you're feeling, I reached out. I spoke to the other educators before I moved him, had worked with the director of special education, well, the assistant director of special education, and felt like it was the best choice for the entire team.
Right. Well, not only does school keep him busy, but I know you do a lot of outdoors activities. And then also one activity that I'm thinking of that you seem really passionate about, and I want to know all about it, is neuromovement. So What is it, first of all? Because I only have a very base understanding of it, and I know our listeners will want to know the details. And how does it work?
So neuromovement is an approach that has the basis of understanding movement is the language to the brain. And so with movement being the language of the brain, it also works off of the idea of brain plasticity and the ability of the brain and the nervous system to change structurally and functionally with this movement experience. What it really looks like is a source of very dynamic sequential movements that offers the child or the individual, it can be for adults also, a kinesthetic experience that evokes brains and cultivates a learning process. So it goes with the concept of we cannot do it to the child or do it for the child. These practitioners are there. It's a holistic approach, and they are connecting with the child beyond the body. They're connecting with the child also mentally, and that's where the neurological component comes into it. They're with the child, guiding them through movements that their body has the ability to undergo. Sometimes children with neurological, let's call it dysfunction at this point, their body might feel like one block. And a child might not know how to differentiate between one hand, one arm, one leg. It just really feels through their nervous system like one solid piece. And so they might not know left to right. They might not know two legs, you know, four limbs at that point. So this process is an approach where it's helping the brain self-organize the information that's being taken in. It does integrate the mind and the body. It is helping the brain function and organize not only physical movement, but thinking about those movements, feeling those movements, the emotion connected to these movements, and the action, the output that is going on through these movements. So it's a very deep, rich concept, but it's incredible. So these practitioners provide functional lessons to the individual. And again, they work with the child where the child is at. That's how it's different from physical therapy, where physical therapy really works with the physical body and not necessarily the feelings and thinking that comes along with it. They're going to move the knee up and down. They're going to move the arm, extend it, compress it. And the child may be getting those sources that they're just embedding that movement with them. But sometimes it's involuntary, truly. We are still unmapping some of the things. That's a concept that they use a lot. It's mapping of the neurons. And so what is mapping? It is giving that movement, the brain, the language of where the body should be moving in space, bringing awareness into it, bringing feeling into it. So a lot of times physical therapy creates a map, but it might not be a map that is connected to anywhere. Archer is currently learning to pull to stand. He can walk assisted. When he's walking with assistance, he is walking more on his ankle because he's not quite connected and learned to feel into his entire foot, into his entire skeletal, like of all of his toes. So he'll walk on his ankles. And yes, it's great to see him walking assisted with somebody or for him to do that with confidence. However, it's creating a map that is not beneficial because we do not walk on our ankles. So he still needs to learn how to use his skeletal structure and engage the bones of his toes, his heel, his inner and outer foot. So I kind of like encourage people to do that just so that he can develop that first.
Mm-hmm.
Neuromovement is incredible. We do it in intensive styles, which means he has multiple lessons a day for a period of anywhere from 3 to 5 days. And they give him these functional lessons where they work with him. And what movement he is creating, they'll create that movement and make sure it's connecting through the spine to be engaging through the central nervous system and the movement be sent to the brain. So they're not correcting what he's doing, but they're providing the information of what is going on. And it all stems from the pelvis to the brain. So we know the spine's connected down in the central nervous system. So anybody really, if we think about it, any movement that we have, usually our pelvis is moving at some point. Even if you're reaching out your arm or you're moving your leg, your pelvis is the powerhouse of your movements. But just to give a small timeline of how much he's grown from this type of approach, he went from at 2 years of age, barely being able to roll over. He had one intensive, a week long of lessons, and started rolling over. We went back 4 weeks later. He came home and started army crawling. We went back 4 weeks later. He came home and started saying his name. And it just continued. His fourth time we came home, it was actually when we were in Pittsburgh seeing Dr. Roman. He sat up on Easter in our hotel room. And he had never sat up before on his own. when moments like that happen, at that point, it was his father and I, and we looked at each other like, did this really just happen? Like, are we imagining this?
Well, where can people learn more?
There might be some noise. Nanny just brought him home from school. I'm trying to find a safe place now. We access a couple of different practitioners. So if they look up neuromovement, they will find the Anant Banyal Center and page. But we also utilize a practitioner, Sylvia Shordyke, that has these children outside of the center, and her website is neurohorizons.world. And both of the places have databases with practitioners all around the world. It is an international practice. And so
I'll find the links and I'll put them in the show notes so that if people navigate to that page associated with this podcast, they'll be able to find it. So Archer's home from school, which reminds me, I want to know more about him. Just to close up, kind of tell us what does he enjoy most? You know, what does he find joy in life? What is he liking about school? What's his personality like? Give us a snapshot.
He loves to be outside. I'm a very outdoorsy individual, and he loves to be outside. It does not matter the element. If it's sunny, if it's raining, if it's snowing, if it's windy, I am a runner and just love to be moving also. That language we're receiving in our brain. So we go on lots of stroller runs, walks, lots of hikes, and also just exploring. I think it's outside is kind of his downtime from having to really use a lot of functional vision, but I put things in place for him to use his functional vision. Like, I usually always wear a bold shirt or something, bold colored shirt, for him to be able to find me. And so I think he kind of just took that. Both his dad and I are kind of adrenaline junkies, and they kind of refer to him as a little gymnast. I've mentioned he's still learning to pull to stand and walk, but he can do somersaults and all sorts of things. He walks like a bear. He still asks for the sprinkler, even though it's like 20 degrees outside right now. And he loves music. He was in a music class from the age of 18 months old all the way to 5 years old with the same instructor. And he started singing songs, and most of it came from there. His language development, I can heavily accredit to not only neuromovement, but also the integration of music in his life. He asks for songs every single night. He loves reading books that have been modified for him. And I truly just try to give him the most normal experience that he can get with his abilities to be integrated into, you know, his environments. He's a social kid. One thing with cortical visual impairment is you can refer to it as face blindness, or the face is very complex. So when we're out and about, he likes to hear voices. And when he hears them, he can decipher whether it's a little bit older gentleman, and he'll say Grandpa Joe or Grandpa Dennis. And I'm like Grandpa Joe or like Grandpa Dennis. If he sees somebody with a beard, he definitely says like Grandpa Joe. And he loves being social. He says hello to people in the grocery store or wherever we are. He loves being with kids that are his own age. And that was the best thing about kindergarten. Yes, it's visually complex, but he loves being at school. And he's starting to have a huge love for animals also. He's a happy, happy boy. Any parent thinks that their child is, you know, is the cutest little being in the world. But I mean, I'll have people come up to me in the grocery store and comment on his hair, his whirly hair, and say, man, he has the best hair in the world. And I'm like, yeah, thank you. You know, there's so much more that you don't know about that, but thank you. And he has a outstanding smile that will light up anybody's day and is really just a bright little boy that charms anybody. I'm very happy with him and with how engaged he is in his world and his environment and just his personality. His personality is a great one. He's now a kindergartner, 5 and a half, so he is learning how to have some defiance and be a little bit manipulative if you don't know him and his ways. But I go with the fact that he can do it. I'm not going to do it for him. Yes, there are things that I assist him with, but when I have the time and I can slow down with him and give him some guided direction, he can do a lot. He can accomplish a lot. At the end of the day, it's seeing him succeed and seeing his bright little smile just beam from ear to ear that I know that I'm doing the right thing.
Well, now I think we're all Team Archer, and you're his biggest cheerleader and his coach. And, you know, what a team. It seems like your advocacy efforts are really paying off, and he has the goods to take those resources that you've been able to facilitate for him and use them. Just to close, sometimes we think about leaving a legacy, and you've probably considered it as well. What do you think your legacy will be?
My voice. Definitely my voice and my willingness to share our story. My willingness to not only share our story, but to provide education along the way and to not do it only for my son, but do it for every child and every parent and professional and educator that comes across a child with cortical visual impairment.
Thank you.
All right. Well, I guess we're all Team Archer now. Thanks to Cheyenne for sitting for this interview and for sitting patiently while I struggled with my recording technology. I might be rusty after that extended summer break. You'll find links to many of the resources Cheyenne mentioned in the show notes, which can be found at cvipodcast.vision. I hope you heard Cheyenne mention one of the first and very important steps she took in becoming an educated parent advocate: the weekly telesupport call for parents of kids with CVI, hosted by the Lighthouse Guild. If you haven't joined, do. To request access, you fill out a form on lighthouseguild.org. I'll add that to the show notes. Or email moderator Judith Millman at judithmillman@aol.com. That's judithmillman@aol.com. I hope not to go too long without saying hello again. So until next time.